I was elected by men and women of all parties and none, by many with great moral courage, who stepped out from the faded flags of the Civil War and voted for a new Ireland, and above all, by the women of Ireland, Manon Aheron.
She was a total tomboy. Wasn't she brought up by her four brothers? And what else could she be?
There was a kind of a driving force behind her. I mean, she was genuinely committed. She was intellectually excited by the law.
How dare any political party talk about political hooks when we should be changing the law in order to make life better and healthier and saner for the people of this country, for the women of this country and the children of this country?
We are marching to stop the destruction of Wood Quay. And we are marching for the construction of civic offices to be constructed elsewhere.
I have such a sense of what the world must take responsibility for.
To my mind, her feminist thing, or her all this, is the law. The sheer inequality of that the law was the one to put right.
I am of Ireland. Come dance with me in Ireland.
Mary Robinson, growing up in Ballina, were you an ambitious young girl?
I was, because I had to keep up with the four brothers. I do joke that that was my early introduction to human rights and equality. And I was always testing myself, you know, trying to run faster, trying to learn faster. Partly because I could see that my brothers were better looking than me. They were... They turned brown in the sun, whereas I went red and was freckled.
And I mean, what was your ambition at that time? What did you want to be?
My first desire, in fact, was to be an astronomer and study the heavenly bodies. And then I got terribly teased because I said that at about six or something, you know, the way families tease. I think what I wanted to do was to be involved in something that would change people's lives. I was very influenced by an aunt of mine who was a nun in India, and the letters that she would write initially to my father, and then we corresponded when I was a teenager. And she kind of opened up that idea that you could make a big change in a very exotic way in a different country. And I wanted to make a difference.
And what sort of child were you, as your parents would have seen you, do you think?
I was a tomboy, definitely. And I was also... always listening to their conversation, and I loved to be with my father when he went out on long calls. And he was a wonderful father. He was a great storyteller. And at the same time, he also spent a great deal of time when he went into these poor homes to see a sick patient. And what I learned, I didn't understand it at the time, was that he was a true doctor. He didn't just prescribe pills. He listened so that he could really find out and diagnose. And often it was a mental as well as physical issue that he was dealing with, and he would always take the time. But I think my parents very much encouraged me to achieve the same potential as my brothers. We were all very much encouraged, and they certainly had to do household chores at least as much as I did.
Well, this is your father's testimony about you growing up, and where you were middle in the family of five with four boys.
Yes.
Mary was the third of five.
Yes.
Well, she had a very happy childhood. She was one of five children, and there was a great relationship between them. She sort of fought her own corner amongst a lot of them, and she had a standing in the family, possibly just because she was the only girl, possibly because her mother, she was a Tess O'Donnell from Condona, and her mother had always said there'd be no family without a Mary. She had to have a Mary, and Mary duly arrived, third. And I think always her mother had a tremendous feeling that this was the most important person in the family, and that is the way it grew up. She became a sort of figurehead. She had a birthday at the end of May, and of the whole family, her birthday was the one that was celebrated. All the birthdays were celebrated. My father, where I was born, a house on the side of the town with good lawns and things, and there Mary's birthday party was a big occasion for 20, 30 things. It was her one. All were put together. So in a sense, she had a very central role in a family in her young days.
So that captures it, does it?
It does, and I remember those parties very well. And my father would take cine films, so we would see those parties during the winter on his camera, on his film.
And that they were the films where you were freckled and plump, and you know your brothers were bronzed in the sun. So did that present problems for you?
Well, yes, in the sense of it was a reason to strive to be better.
And also then your relationship with your mother, what was that?
My mother was a wonderful figure, both in the family and in the town. Very warm, somebody that people wanted to confide in, to go to. And she was great fun. And she was also somebody who had a mischievous sense, a great sense of being able to laugh at our childhood jokes and vulgarity, etc. And at the same time, she had a real sense that the Burkes were a very important family in Mayo, and that somehow, because of the background, partly a colonial background with great uncles and then my uncle Paget, who was a chief justice in various countries and had been knighted by the Queen, and there were photographs of my father and my grandmother with Sir Paget Burke, and that was all part of the Burke history. And the more my mother talked about this, the more I was uncomfortable with the idea, because I had this great sense of fairness and of equality, and it was very much ingrained in me. And I argued a few times, and then there was no point, because this was part of my mother's sense of herself. And she was very proud of my father, loved him beyond belief. I mean, that was very evident. There was a very strong love between the two of them, but she had him on a kind of pedestal, as we all did. And it was important to her that we would know how important the Burke family were.
But there were disadvantages in that too, weren't there, in a small town?
Yes, I think so. And that was part of what I didn't want to have, which was that kind of distinction, because we already had it. Those of us who went to Miss Ruddy's, which was the small private school, we had a sense imbued in us in that subtle way in a small town that we were better than the convent girls. And even that I felt very uncomfortable about, because I was taking the Christian religion very seriously, and the gospel, and that idea that... you know, as the Universal Declaration put it, and I read that later, you know, that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. That for me was a very fundamental idea.
So what form did it take that the Miss Ruddy's school pupils believing themselves better?
Well, when we would meet, we would be going up the hill in Ardnaree to the private school, and some of the girls would be coming down to go to the convent, and there would be quite a lot of slagging going on and insults both ways.
And then there was that incident in the cinema too. That was another example of your mother pulling rank and marching to the cinema to get her children out from this B movie, which was a horror movie that you'd all wanted to go to.
Yes, we were very keen on horror movies, and we would put my brother Adrian up as the youngest to go and ask, could we go to the cinema? And there would be something very, a cowboy film or something in the other cinema, and he would ask with those, you know, innocent eyes, could we go to the cinema? And then we would go off to the other one. And I was terribly embarrassed. It was a moment of great shame.
What happened?
The horror movie ground to a halt. You know, you could hear it grinding, and the lights went on. And then the cinema owner said, would Mrs. Dr. Burke's children please get up and come out? And I looked around and I could see my mother behind him. And I was so embarrassed, because we had to get up and walk out of the cinema. And I got smacked for that. And they watched much more closely what we were looking at.
But you were smacked. I mean, that was part of childhood in those years, wasn't
it?
Parents did smack their children.
Absolutely, yes. And we had that that phrase, because my father used a long, it was like a short rubber spear rather than a knife. It was a long thing, and he used that usually on the hand, but sometimes on the bottom.
And that hurt?
It hurt a bit. Mm. Yeah, it was never done with malice. So it was we were much more affected by the fact that he was smacking us than the hurt of the smacking.
That was my question, yes. Now, you were, as you said already, one girl among four brothers, and this is your brother, Adrian.
She was a total tomboy. Wasn't she brought up by her four brothers? And what else could she be?
So what impact did that have, do you believe, on your character and your personality?
I certainly felt that it was important to be as good as my brothers at whatever, but I also noticed when I was kicking a ball in a scroan, running along the sand, that they were playing, and I was somehow doing two things. I was playing, but I was also looking out to sea and remembering a conversation between my parents the night before, particularly my father's frustration. He would say to my mother, you know, I feel, you know, why can't we talk about the illnesses, cancer, tuberculosis? But in particular, I loved the way he would express frustration when there was a delivery in the home and he would come back and he'd say to my mother, I heard that expression again, the question to me, is it a boy or a child? And I loved the fact that he didn't like that preference for the boy child. And so even though I felt that in some ways my brothers were luckier than me to be boys, I was always encouraged by my parents.
And you were in some ways the sort of the leader. Your father, again, says this about you.
And we always felt, even in those days, and I think our brothers would say the same, that even in the smallest things, there was nothing impossible to Mary. She had a great sense of humour, she had a great sense of fun, but nothing was impossible to her. If she wanted to do something, she would do it. Somehow it would come about. If she wanted to go on a picnic and it was a wet day and miserable and all the rest of it, that wouldn't stop her. She said, well, we'll go. We'll build chicks out the turf, we'll build a fire, we'll cook sausages. Nothing was impossible to her. And that, I think her four brothers would certainly say that.
My father's voice there reminds me that I certainly did take the leadership in playing. I mean, I was Batman and my brother Henry had to be Robin and Adrian was the victim usually. And I loved those games. I loved the kind of opportunity to lead in those games. And the way in which we were encouraged to be able to play and ultimately had a playroom. We initially started with dividing the dining room up into five corners, four corners in the middle. But when we had our playroom, that was a wonderful place for us to play together.
And in terms of schooling, what were the major influences?
I was a great reader. And in boarding school in Mount Anville, when I went there, I was mentored to some extent by one of the nuns, Mother Stevenson, who later was called Sister Stevenson, Steve, as we called her. And she taught us mathematics and Latin, but she was aware that I needed intellectual stimulus and we would have long conversations in her room. She read the Irish Times, which we weren't allowed to read. We were supposed to read the Irish Independent, but she allowed me to read her Irish Times. And I spent a lot of time in the school library reading, and I was instinctively drawn to those who tried to change the world. I was interested in Michael Davitt because of Mayo. And because of his poor background and what he achieved and the things he was interested in. I read about Martin Luther King. I came across Eleanor Roosevelt because some years earlier, in 1948, she had chaired this commission for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And having a woman chair something important was something that drew me to her. And in a way, she looked a little bit like my mother. She had the same, not very attractive, but very compelling personality rather than beauty. And that also attracted me to her.
Were you homesick when you went to boarding school? So you were age 10, weren't you, when you came up to Dublin to Mount Anville?
Well, initially I was terribly excited, absolutely dying to get away from my home in Mayo and see the world and go to boarding school like my older brothers had done. And I was distressed that my mother was crying. I was almost ashamed of her, you know, to go away and let me be at this exciting boarding school, which turned out to be not quite so exciting because I had been used to being very tomboyish and free and, you know, whistling when I walked. And we were told, no, we had to walk on the side of the corridors and, you know, have our hands almost in a prayer-like way. And we were to be very demure and not talk in the corridors. So by Christmas, when I was going back to school, I was more lonely. But basically, I got on very well at Mount Anville. I enjoyed school. I enjoyed the hockey and the tennis and the drama and the dancing. And basically, we were given a very good education.
And what was it like being in an all-girl environment then?
I also enjoyed that very much. It was the first time I'd had girl friends. And we used to get together underneath the dormitory cubicles and talk at night. And of course, you were penalised. I tended to have a very volatile performance in Mount Anville. I would get a green ribbon and then I would lose it because I'd be caught in the dormitory. I would get a blue ribbon and then I would lose it. So I wasn't consistent as some others were.
And what were you talking about?
I think sharing secrets, sharing family relationships, that very special way in which girls at a certain age can have bonds. One of the important ones for me, which continued into adult life, was with Mary Courtney, who is now married in Switzerland. And she came to my home and she loved my mother because she was such a warm, individual and often spoke about that. And we went to the Yates Summer School together and shared beds in a dormitory. I remember they were horsehair mattresses. They were bumpy, lumpy. But it was great fun because we knew that Yeats liked ghost stories at some stage. So we frightened each other with these stories. But also we heard some wonderful lecturers. I remember Thomas Henn and a whole lot of very, very good Yeats scholars who, again, opened my eyes to understanding what poetry was trying to convey. And that was something that stayed with me and still does.
And you were a very religious person then, weren't you, in your teenage years?
Very, and very convinced of the true Christian gospel of Jesus and that standard. And in a way, I saw my grandmother living up to that standard. And when what were known then as tinkers, tinker women, would come to her door, she would give clothes, she would give food, she would sometimes give money. And even my grandfather, who was religious, would complain. I remember that very well. And I remember admiring my grandmother because she was trying to live the true gospel and they were daily communicants. And I was very proud to go to the first midnight mass in Ballina with my grandmother because she was somebody that I saw was trying to live that faith. I was very engaged in concern about developing countries and babies there, that they would be baptized, that they would become good Catholics and that they would obviously develop. And I spent most of my money on supporting black babies and giving them terrible names like Aloysius and Alphonsus and the names of the obscure saints that we had to recite in mass. But my religion was very, very important to me.
And you thought at that stage that you might indeed become a nun?
I think that was in part the religious feeling, but it was also that I had very few options. My friends were talking about what they would do maybe for a year or two before marrying, but marrying was definitely the goal at about 18 or 19. And I wasn't at all interested in marrying. And I didn't have the kind of talent to be a writer or an artist. I actually tried to write, especially after the Yates Summer School, and I found I just didn't. I couldn't get that novel going. And so I became more interested in the possibility of having a life like Auntie Ivy. And that was important to me, to try and work in somewhere like India and do what she was doing. So in my last year in boarding school, when I was 16, I was 17 in May, I thought that really that was my best option and went to see the Reverend Mother Provincial, who was visiting the convent, as she regularly did, Reverend Mother Sheeran. And I was convinced that, you know, she would be delighted to have a new postulant, because we saw these postulants coming and everybody was always very pleased. But instead, she looked at me very shrewdly and she said, "Well, Mary, I've been looking at your record and, you know, you're a bright student. You've done well in school, but I don't know that you're really necessarily cut out to be a nun. Maybe you should go away for a year." And I felt quite chastened, in fact. When I told my parents, they were delighted that I was going to be a nun. They were very proud of that. And they were very pleased that I wasn't going in immediately, that I would have an extra year. So they decided to make it a very special year and to send me away to Paris to the finishing school, Mademoiselle Anita's, but that I would stay in the place that was run by the Sacred Heart Nuns, which was a kind of foyer for those going to Mademoiselle Anita's.
So you went to Paris with what expectations?
To spend the year there and to learn, improve my French, because I had learned my French through Morin's French grammar and never spoken French, and to come back then, become a nun and go and work on the missions as my aunt had done.
What was your first impression? That was the first time you were in Paris, was it?
Oh, yes.
First time you were out of Ireland, was it?
It wasn't the first time, but almost the first time.
What was the impression that Paris made on you?
That first evening was quite shocking to me. I arrived at this convent in Rue Saint-Dominique. It had a very heavy door and you pressed a bell and the door was opened and there was a very recognisable sister inside, dressed as the sisters of the Sacred Heart Nuns were in Dublin, and she greeted me in a language which I completely didn't understand, and I realised that was French. And we went in and we more or less used sign language with each other, and she pointed to where there was a place set for one person with a bowl and two glasses, and she brought in some soup, And then she went away and came back with a carafe of red wine and began to pour wine into the second glass. And I was appalled because I was a pioneer and he was a nun pouring wine. And so somehow that mixture, it was really disturbing. I remember going into the chapel in the foyer that night and kneeling down and praying in my confusion. And I had a lot to learn in a very short time because French was very much the only language spoken in that foyer. That's where I learned my French. In Mademoiselle Anita's, I was initially in the English part of it until Christmas, but my French had improved so much that I was moved into the French part after Christmas. And the teaching there was really very good. They were professors from the Sorbonne who were teaching us philosophy, history, culture. It was a wonderful experience, and I was ready for it.
And you also experienced Paris.
Very much so. I walked the streets of Paris. I walked along the Seine and saw all those bookshops. I was fortunate enough to be taken to the Jeu de Paume, the Louvre, the wonderful buildings of Paris, and seeing it through the eyes of very experienced curators, very experienced experts, so that I knew what to look at and what to see. But most of all, I just loved the culture, the Left Bank. I had an English Canadian or Irish Canadian friend, Cherry, who was very different from me. She was enjoying being in Paris with her mother and her sister, staying in a nice apartment. She was quite well off, her family were, and she was determined to bring me out of myself.
And you actually heard Edith Piaf perform?
Yes, I did. I still remember going along to the Odeon Theatre, up in the gods, and that was absolutely incredible for me because she was small, bird-like, white face. I still remember it so well, but her voice and the way she sang and everybody sort of leaned forward and almost drank in her songs, and they were all over Paris at the time.
And what else struck you about Paris?
I noticed that there were police at the metro stations and we had to carry identity papers because of the Algerian war. And that if women were wearing headscarves or looked Muslim, and even more so young Muslims in Paris, they were always stopped and moved aside. You saw it happening. And I was reading the papers about what was happening in Algeria, and I had a real sense of identity with the Algerians. And I saw that most of the Paris press was very much on the French side, but there were left-wing papers. And we spent a lot of time in the Left Bank. We went to the cinema in the morning and saw films like Jules et Jim, which, you know, were much the talk at that time. And it was just a very different atmosphere. Cherry encouraged me to use makeup, and I realised that I had got tall and slim and was actually quite good looking, to my astonishment.
And you smoked Galois cigarettes. So wasn't this now a question of how to get her into the nunnery now that she's seen Paris?
Well, that was more an internal, very deep intellectual questioning, because very soon after my confusion of the first few days, the confusion of language and the confusion of a nun pouring wine, I also was in an atmosphere that encouraged questioning. And all of the questions that were in my mind about the sort of the lack of choices for a woman or a girl, that feeling of the authoritarian church, the priests, the altar boys, they were all boys and men, that we weren't allowed to question. In Ireland, we weren't encouraged to question. Be like a child, don't ask questions, accept the situation. And I was in an atmosphere where you were encouraged to ask questions, you were encouraged to think, and we were taught about the philosophers. And I really began to not in any way reject the basic gospel of Jesus, because I do think and still think that that's the highest standard that we can live to. And if we live to it, then we lead a good life. But the way in which this was being manifested in an authoritarian and cramping way, especially for women and girls, was something that I felt deeply angry about in the end. And so I found that when I went to Mass, especially in the cathedral, Notre Dame, everything about it, the fact that it was such a tourist centre, the riches of the church, but the seeming lack of connection with very poor people, even in Paris itself, all of that challenged me.
And that challenge and how you decided to decide on law as a career, we'll come back to after this break, Mary Robbins.